As a fishing net, it was useless. Too stiff and heavy and with a weave that wasn't tight enough. But it was perfect as a lure. Trailing freely in the water, it proved irresistibly attractive to fish, and even more so when seaweed started growing on it. Fish that were local in their ambit made the net their neighborhood, and the quick ones, the ones that tended to streak by, the Dorados, slowed down to visit the new development. Neither the residents nor the travelers ever suspected that a hook was hidden in the weave. There were some days, too few unfortunately, when I could have all the fish I cared to gaff. At such times, I hunted far beyond the needs of my hunger or my capacity to cure. There simply wasn't enough space on the lifeboat or lines on the raft to dry so many strips of Dorado, flying fish, jacks, groupers, and mackerels, let alone space in my stomach to eat them. I kept what I could and gave the rest to Richard Parker. During those days of plenty, I laid hands on so many fish that my body began to glitter from all the fish scales that became stuck to it. I wore these spots of shine and silver like tilaks, the marks of color that we Hindus wear on our foreheads as symbols of the divine. If sailors had come upon me then, I'm sure they would have thought I was a fish god standing atop his kingdom, and they wouldn't have stopped. Those were the good days. They were rare. Turtles were an easy catch indeed, as the survival manual said they were. Under the hunting and gathering heading, they would go under gathering. Solid in build though they were, like tanks, they were neither fast nor powerful swimmers. With just one hand gripped around a back flipper, it was possible to hold on to a turtle. But the survival manual failed to mention that a turtle caught was not a turtle had. It still needed to be brought aboard. And hauling a struggling 130-pound turtle aboard a lifeboat was anything but easy. It was a labor that demanded feats of strength worthy of Hanuman. I did it by bringing the victim alongside the bow of the boat, carapace against hull, and tying a rope to its neck, a front flipper and a back flipper. Then I pulled until I thought my arms would come apart and my head would explode. I ran the ropes around the tarpaulin hooks on the opposite side of the bow. Every time a rope yielded a little, I secured my gain before the rope slipped back. Inch by inch, a turtle was heaved out of the water. It took time. I remember one green sea turtle that hung from the side of the lifeboat for 2 days, the whole while thrashing about madly, free flippers beating in the air. Luckily, at the last stage, on the lip of the gunwale, it would often happen that a turtle would help me without meaning to. In an attempt to free its painfully twisted flippers, it would pull on them. If I pulled at the same moment, our conflicting efforts sometimes came together, and suddenly it would happen, easily. In the most dramatic fashion imaginable, a turtle would surge over the gunwale and slide on to the tarpaulin. I would fall back, exhausted, but jubilant. Green sea turtles gave more meat than hawksbills, and their belly shells were thinner. But they tended to be bigger than hawksbills, often too big to lift out of the water for the weakened castaway that I became. Lord, to think that I'm a strict vegetarian. To think that when I was a child, I always shuddered when I snapped open a banana because it sounded to me like the breaking of an animal's neck. I descended to a level of savagery I never imagined possible. Chapter 67. The underside of the raft became host to a multitude of sea life, like the net, but smaller in form. It started with a soft green algae that clung to the life jackets. Stiffer algae of a darker kind joined it. They did well and became thick. Animal life appeared. The first that I saw were tiny translucent shrimp, hardly half an inch long. They were followed by fish no bigger that looked like they were permanently under X-ray. Their internal organs showed through their transparent skins. After that, I noticed the black worms with the white spines, the green gelatinous slugs with the primitive limbs, the inch-long, motley-colored fish with the pot bellies, and lastly the crabs, half to three-quarters of an inch across and brown in color. I tried everything but the worms, including the algae. Only the crabs didn't have an unpalatably bitter or salty taste. Every time they appeared, I popped them one after another into my mouth like candy until there were none left. I couldn't control myself. It was always a long wait between fresh crops of crabs. The hull of the lifeboat invited life too, in the form of small gooseneck barnacles. I sucked their fluid. Their flesh made for good fishing bait. I became attached to these oceanic hitchhikers, though they weighed the raft down a little. They provided distraction, like Richard Parker. I spent many hours doing nothing but lying on my side, a life jacket pushed out of place a few inches, like a curtain from a window, so that I might have a clear view. What I saw was an upside-down town, small, quiet, and peaceable, whose citizens went about with the sweet civility of angels. The sight was a welcome relief for my frayed nerves. Chapter 68. My sleep pattern changed. Though I rested all the time, I rarely slept longer than an hour or so at a stretch, even at night. It was not the ceaseless motion of the sea that disturbed me, nor the wind. You get used to those the way you get used to lumps in a mattress. It was apprehension and anxiety that roused me. It was remarkable how little sleep I got by on, unlike Richard Parker. He became a champion napper. Most of the time, he rested beneath the tarpaulin. But on calm days, when the sun was not too harsh, and on calm nights, he came out. One of his favorite positions in the open was lying on the stern bench on his side, stomach overhanging the edge of it, front and back legs extending down the side benches. It was a lot of tiger to squeeze onto a fairly narrow ledge, but he managed it by making his back very round. When he was truly sleeping, he laid his head on his front legs, but when his mood was slightly more active, when he might choose to open his eyes and look about, he turned his head and lay his chin on the gunwale. Another favorite position of his was sitting with his back to me, his rear half resting on the floor of the boat and his front half on the bench, his face buried into the stern, paws right next to his head, looking as if we were playing hide-and-seek and he were the one counting. In this position, he tended to lie very still, with only the occasional twitching of his ears to indicate that he was not necessarily sleeping. Chapter 69. On many nights, I was convinced I saw a light in the distance. Each time I set off a flare. When I had used up the rocket flares, I expended the hand flares. Were they ships that failed to see me? The light of rising or setting stars bouncing off the ocean? Breaking waves that moonlight and forlorn hope fashioned into illusion? Whatever the case, every time it was for nothing. Never a result. Always the bitter emotion of hope raised and dashed. In time I gave up entirely on being saved by a ship. If the horizon was 2.5 miles away at an altitude of 5 feet, how far away was it when I was sitting against the mast of my raft, my eyes not even 3 feet above the water? What chance was there that a ship crossing the whole great big Pacific would cut into such a tiny circle? Not only that, that it would cut into such a tiny circle and see me. What chance was there of that? No, Humanity and its unreliable ways could not be counted upon. It was land I had to reach. Hard, firm, certain land. I remember the smell of the spent hand flare shells. By some freak of chemistry, they smelled exactly like cumin. It was intoxicating. I sniffed the plastic shells, and immediately Pondicherry came to life in my mind, a marvelous relief from the disappointment of calling for help and not being heard. The experience was very strong. Nearly a hallucination. From a single smell, a whole town arose. Now, when I smell cumin, I see the Pacific Ocean. Richard Parker always froze when a hand flare hissed to life. His eyes, round pupils the size of pinpricks, fixed on the light steadily. It was too bright for me. A blinding white center with a pinkish-red aureole. I had to turn away. I held the flare in the air at arm's length and waved it slowly. For about a minute, heat showered down upon my forearm, and everything was weirdly lit. Water around the raft, until a moment before opaquely black, showed itself to be crowded with fish. Chapter 70. Butchering a turtle was hard work. My first one was a small hawksbill. It was its blood that tempted me, the good, nutritious, salt-free drink promised by the survival manual. My thirst was that bad. I took hold of the turtle's shell and grappled with one of its back flippers. When I had a good grip, I turned it over in the water and attempted to pull it onto the raft. The thing was thrashing violently. I would never be able to deal with it on the raft. Either I let it go, or I tried my luck on the lifeboat. I looked up. It was a hot and cloudless day. Richard Parker seemed to tolerate my presence at the bow on such days, when the air was like the inside of an oven and he did not move from under the tarpaulin until sunset. I held on to one of the turtle's back flippers with one hand, and I pulled on the rope to the lifeboat with the other. It was not easy climbing aboard. When I had managed it, I jerked the turtle in the air and brought it onto its back on the tarpaulin. As I had hoped, Richard Parker did no more than growl once or twice. He was not up to exerting himself in such heat. My determination was grim and blind. I felt I had no time to waste. I turned to the survival manual as to a cookbook. It said to lay the turtle on its back. Done. It advised that a knife should be inserted into the neck to sever the arteries and veins running through it. I looked at the turtle. There was no neck. The turtle had retracted into its shell. All that showed of its head was its eyes and its beak, surrounded by circles of skin. It was looking at me upside down with a stern expression. I took hold of the knife and, hoping to goad it, poked a front flipper. It only shrank further into its shell. I decided on a more direct approach. As confidently as if I had done it 1,000 times, I jammed the knife just to the right of the turtle's head, at an angle. I pushed the blade deep into the folds of skin and twisted it. The turtle retreated even further, favoring the side where the blade was, and suddenly shot its head forward, beak snapping at me viciously. I jumped back. All four flippers came out, and the creature tried to make its getaway. It rocked on its back, flippers beating wildly and head shaking from side to side. I took hold of a hatchet and brought it down on the turtle's neck, gashing it. Bright red blood shot out. I grabbed the beaker and collected about 300 milliliters, a pop can's worth. I might have got much more, 1 liter I would guess, but the turtle's beak was sharp and its front flippers were long and powerful, with 2 claws on each. the blood I managed to collect gave off no particular smell. I took a sip. It tasted warm and animal, if my memory is right. It's hard to remember first impressions. I drank the blood to the last drop. I thought I would use the hatchet to remove the tough belly shell, but it proved easier with the saw-toothed edge of the knife. I set one foot at the center of the shell, the other clear of the flailing flippers. The leathery skin at the head end of the shell was easy cutting, except around the flippers. Sawing away at the rim, however, where shell met shell, was very hard work, especially as the turtle wouldn't stop moving. By the time I had gone all the way around, I was bathed in sweat and exhausted. I pulled on the belly shell. It lifted reluctantly with a wet sucking sound. Inner life was revealed, twitching and jerking. Muscles, fat, blood, guts and bones. And still the turtle thrashed about. I slashed its neck to the vertebrae. It made no difference. Flippers continued to beat. With two blows of the hatchet, I cut its head right off. The flippers did not stop. Worse, the separated head went on gulping for air and blinking its eyes. I pushed it into the sea. The living rest of the turtle I lifted and dropped into Richard Parker's territory. He was making noises and sounded as if he were about to stir. He had probably smelled the turtle's blood. I fled to the raft. I watched sullenly as he loudly appreciated my gift and made a joyous mess of himself. I was utterly spent. The effort of butchering the turtle had hardly seemed worth the cup of blood. I started thinking seriously about how I was going to deal with Richard Parker. This forbearance on his part on hot, cloudless days, if that is what it was and not simple laziness, was not good enough. I couldn't always be running away from him. I needed safe access to the locker and the top of the tarpaulin, no matter the time of day or the weather, no matter his mood. It was rights I needed. The sort of rights that come with might. It was time to impose myself and carve out my territory. Chapter 71. To those who should ever find themselves in a predicament such as I was in, I would recommend the following program. 1. Choose a day when the waves are small but regular. You want a sea that will put on a good show when your lifeboat is broadside to it, though without capsizing your boat. 2. Stream your sea anchor full out to make your lifeboat as stable and comfortable as possible. Prepare your safe haven from the lifeboat in case you should need it. You most likely will. If you can, devise some means of bodily protection. Almost anything can make a shield. Wrapping clothes or blankets around your limbs will make for a minimal form of armor. 3. Now comes the difficult part. You must provoke the animal that is afflicting you. Tiger, rhinoceros, ostrich, wild boar, brown bear, no matter the beast, you must get its goat. The best way to do this will most likely be to go to the edge of your territory and noisily intrude into the neutral zone. I did just that. I went to the edge of the tarpaulin and stamped upon the middle bench as I mildly blew into the whistle. It is important that you make a consistent, recognizable noise to signal your aggression. But you must be careful. You want to provoke your animal, but only so much. You don't want it to attack you outright. If it does, God be with you. You will be torn to pieces, trampled flat, disemboweled, very likely eaten. You don't want that. You want an animal that is piqued, peeved, vexed, bothered, irked, annoyed, but not homicidal. Under no circumstances should you step into your animal's territory. Contain your aggression to staring into its eyes and hurling toots and taunts. 4. When your animal has been roused, work in all bad faith to provoke a border intrusion. A good way of bringing this about, in my experience, is to back off slowly as you are making your noises. Be sure not to break eye contact. As soon as the animal has laid a paw in your territory, or even made a determined advance into the neutral territory, you have achieved your goal. Don't be picky or legalistic as to where its paw actually landed. Be quick to be affronted. Don't wait to construe. Misconstrue as fast as you can. The point here is to make your animal understand that its upstairs neighbor is exceptionally persnickety about territory. 5. Once your animal has trespassed upon your territory, be unflagging in your outrage. Whether you have fled to your safe haven off the lifeboat or retreated to the back of your territory on the lifeboat, start blowing your whistle at full blast and immediately trip the sea anchor. These two actions are of pivotal importance. You must not delay putting them into effect. If you can help your lifeboat get broadside to the waves by other means, with an oar, for example, apply yourself right away. The faster your lifeboat broaches to the waves, the better. 6. Blowing a whistle continuously is exhausting for the weakened castaway, but you must not falter. Your alarmed animal must associate its increasing nausea with the shrill cries of the whistle. You can help things move along by standing at the end of your boat, feet on opposing gunwales, and swaying in rhythm to the motion imparted by the sea. However slight you are, however large your lifeboat, you will be amazed at the difference this will make. I assure you, in no time you'll have your lifeboat rocking and rolling like Elvis Presley. Just don't forget to be blowing your whistle all the while. And mind you, don't make your lifeboat capsize. 7. You want to keep going until the animal that is your burden, your tiger, your rhinoceros, whatever, is properly green about the gills with seasickness. You want to hear it heaving and dry-retching. You want to see it lying at the bottom of the lifeboat, limbs trembling, eyes rolled back, a deathly rattle coming from its gaping mouth. And all the while, you must be shattering the animal's ears with the piercing blows of your whistle. If you become sick yourself, don't waste your vomit by sending it overboard. Vomit makes an excellent border guard. Puke on the edges of your territory. 8. When your animal appears good and sick, you can stop. Seasickness comes on quickly, but it takes a long while to go away. You don't want to overstate your case. No one dies of nausea, but it can seriously sap the will to live. When enough is enough, stream the sea anchor. Try to give shade to your animal if it has collapsed in direct sunlight, and make sure it has water available when it recovers, with anti-seasickness tablets dissolved in it, if you have any. Dehydration is a serious danger at this point. Otherwise, retreat to your territory and leave your animal in peace. Water, rest and relaxation, besides a stable lifeboat, will bring it back to life. The animal should be allowed to recover fully before going through steps 1 to 8 again. 9. Treatment should be repeated until the association in the animal's mind between the sound of the whistle and the feeling of intense incapacitating nausea is fixed and totally unambiguous. Thereafter, the whistle alone will deal with trespassing or any other untoward behavior. Just one shrill blow, and you will see your animal shudder with malaise and repair at top speed to the safest, furthest part of its territory. Once this level of training is reached, use of the whistle should be sparing. Chapter 72. In my case, to protect myself from Richard Parker while I trained him, I made a shield with a turtle shell. I cut a notch on each side of the shell and connected them with a length of rope. The shield was heavier than I would have liked, but do soldiers ever get to choose their ordnance? The first time I tried, Richard Parker bared his teeth, rotated his ears full round, vomited a short guttural roar, and charged. A great full-clawed paw rose in the air and cuffed my shield. The blow sent me flying off the boat. I hit the water and instantly let go of the shield. It sank without a trace after hitting me in the shin. I was beside myself with terror, of Richard Parker, but also of being in the water. In my mind, a shark was at that very second shooting up for me. I swam for the raft in frantic strokes, precisely the sort of wild thrashing that sharks find so deliciously inviting. Luckily, there were no sharks. I reached the raft, let out all the rope, and sat with my arms wrapped around my knees and my head down, trying to put out the fire of fear that was blazing within me. It was a long time before the trembling of my body stopped completely. I stayed on the raft for the rest of that day and the whole night. I did not eat or drink. I was at it again next time I caught a turtle. Its shell was smaller, lighter, and made for a better shield. Once more I advanced and started stamping on the middle bench with my foot. I wonder if those who hear this story will understand that my behavior was not an act of insanity or a covert suicide attempt, but a simple necessity. Either I tamed him, made him see who was number one and who was number two, or I died the day I wanted to climb aboard the lifeboat during rough weather and he objected. If I survived my apprenticeship as a high seas animal trainer, it was because Richard Parker did not really want to attack me. Tigers, indeed all animals, do not favor violence as a means of settling scores. When animals fight, it is with the intent to kill and with the understanding that they may be killed. A clash is costly, and so animals have a full system of cautionary signals designed to avoid a showdown, and they are quick to back down when they feel they can. Rarely will a tiger attack a fellow predator without warning. Typically, a head-on rush for the adversary will be made with much snarling and growling. But just before it is too late, the tiger will freeze, the menace rumbling deep in its throat. It will appraise the situation. If it decides that there is no threat, it will turn away, feeling that its point has been made. Richard Parker made his point with me 4 times. 4 times he struck at me with his right paw and sent me overboard, and 4 times I lost my shield. I was terrified before, during, and after each attack, and I spent a long time shivering with fear on the raft. Eventually, I learned to read the signals he was sending me. I found that with his ears, his eyes, his whiskers, his teeth, his tail, and his throat, he spoke a simple, forcefully punctuated language that told me what his next move might be. I learned to back down before he lifted his paw in the air. Then I made my point, feet on the gunwale, boat rolling, my single-note language blasting from the whistle, and Richard Parker moaning and gasping at the bottom of the boat. My 5th shield lasted me the rest of his training. Chapter 73. My greatest wish, other than salvation, was to have a book. A long book with a never-ending story. One I could read again and again with new eyes and a fresh understanding each time. Alas, there was no scripture in the lifeboat. I was a disconsolate Arjuna in a battered chariot without the benefit of Krishna's words. The first time I came upon a Bible in the bedside table of a hotel room in Canada, I burst into tears. I sent a contribution to the Gideons the very next day with a note urging them to spread the range of their activity to all places where worn and weary travelers might lay down their heads, not just to hotel rooms, and that they should leave not only Bibles, but other sacred writings as well. I cannot think of a better way to spread the faith. No thundering from a pulpit, no condemnation from bad churches, no peer pressure. Just a book of scripture quietly waiting to say hello, as gentle and powerful as a little girl's kiss on your cheek. At the very least, if I had had a good novel. But there was only the survival manual, which I must have read 10,000 times over the course of my ordeal. I kept a diary. It's hard to read. I wrote as small as I could. I was afraid I would run out of paper. There's not much to it. Words scratched on a page trying to capture a reality that overwhelmed me. I started it a week or so after the sinking of the Simsum. Before that, I was too busy and scattered. The entries are not dated or numbered. What strikes me now is how time is captured. Several days, several weeks, all on one page. I talked about what you might expect, about things that happened and how I felt, about what I caught and what I didn't, about seas and weather, about problems and solutions, about Richard Barker. All very practical stuff. Chapter 74. I practiced religious rituals that I adapted to the circumstances. Solitary masses without priests or consecrated communion hosts. Darshans without murtis and pujas with turtle meat for prasad. Acts of devotion to Allah not knowing where Mecca was and getting my Arabic wrong. They brought me comfort, that is certain. But it was hard. Oh, it was hard. Faith in God is an opening up, a letting go, a deep trust, a free act of love. But sometimes it was so hard to love. Sometimes my heart was sinking so fast with anger, desolation, and weariness, I was afraid it would sink to the very bottom of the Pacific and I would not be able to lift it back up. At such moments, I tried to elevate myself. I would touch the turban I had made with the remnants of my shirt, and I would say aloud, "This is God's hat." I would pat my pants and say aloud, "This is God's attire." I would point to Richard Barker and say aloud, "This is God's cat." I would point to the lifeboat and say aloud, "This is God's ark." I would spread my hands wide and say aloud, "These are God's wide acres." I would point at the sky and say aloud, "This is God's ear." And in this way, I would remind myself of creation and of my place in it. But God's hat was always unraveling. God's pants were falling apart. God's cat was a constant danger. God's ark was a jail. God's wide acres were slowly killing me. God's ear didn't seem to be listening. Despair was a heavy blackness that let no light in or out. It was a hell beyond expression. I thank God it always passed. A school of fish appeared around the net, or a knot cried out to be re-knotted. Or I thought of my family, of how they were spared this terrible agony. The blackness would stir and eventually go away, and God would remain, a shining point of light in my heart. I would go on loving. Chapter 75.
On the day when I estimated it was Mother's birthday, I sang Happy Birthday to her out loud.
Chapter 76.
I got into the habit of cleaning up after Richard Barker. As soon as I became aware that he had had a bowel movement, I went about getting to it. A risky operation involving nudging his feces my way with the gaff and reaching for them from the tarpaulin. Feces can be infected with parasites. This does not matter with animals in the wild, since they rarely spend any time next to their feces and mostly have a neutral relationship to them. Tree dwellers hardly see them at all, and land animals normally excrete and move on. In the compact territory of a zoo, however, the case is quite different, and to leave feces in an animal's enclosure is to invite reinfection by encouraging the animal to eat them, animals being gluttons for anything that remotely resembles food. That is why enclosures are cleaned, out of concern for the intestinal health of animals, not to spare the eyes and noses of visitors. But upholding the Patel family's reputation for high standards in zookeeping was not my concern in the case at hand. In a matter of weeks, Richard Barker became constipated and his bowel movements came no more than once a month, so my dangerous janitoring was hardly worth it from a sanitary point of view. It was for another reason that I did it. It was because the first time Richard Barker relieved himself in the lifeboat, I noticed that he tried to hide the result. The significance of this was not lost on me. To display his feces openly, to flaunt the smell of them, would have been a sign of social dominance. Conversely, to hide them, or try to, was a sign of deference. Of deference to me. I could tell that it made him nervous. He stayed low, his head cocked back and his ears flat to the sides, a quiet, sustained growl coming from him. I proceeded with exceptional alertness and deliberation, not only to preserve my life, but also to give him the right signal. The right signal was that when I had his feces in my hand, I rolled them about for some seconds, brought them close to my nose and sniffed them loudly, and swung my gaze his way a few times in a showy manner, glaring at him wide-eyed, with fear, if only he knew, long enough to give him the willies, but not so long as to provoke him. And with each swing of my gaze, I blew in a low, menacing way in the whistle. By doing this, by badgering him with my eyes, for of course, with all animals, including us, to stare is an aggressive act, and by sounding that whistle cry that had such ominous associations in his mind, I made clear to Richard Barker that it was my right, my lordly right, to fondle and sniff his feces if I wanted to. So you see, it was not good zookeeping I was up to, but psychological bullying. And it worked. Richard Barker never stared back. His gaze always floated in mid-air, neither on me nor off me. It was something I could feel as much as I felt his balls of excrement in my hand. Mastery in the making. The exercise always left me utterly drained from the tension, yet exhilarated. Since we are on the subject, I became as constipated as Richard Barker. It was the result of our diet, too little water and too much protein. For me, relieving myself, almost a monthly act, was hardly that. It was a long-drawn, arduous, and painful event that left me bathing in sweat and helpless with exhaustion. A trial worse than a high fever.
Chapter 77.
As the cartons of survival rations diminished, I reduced my intake till I was following instructions exactly, holding myself to only 2 biscuits every 8 hours. I was continuously hungry. I thought about food obsessively. The less I had to eat, the larger became the portions I dreamed of. My fantasy meals grew to be the size of India. A Ganges of dal soup, hot chapatis the size of Rajasthan, bowls of rice as big as Uttar Pradesh, sambars to flood all of Tamil Nadu, ice cream heaped as high as the Himalayas. My dreaming became quite expert. All ingredients for my dishes were always in fresh and plentiful supply. The oven or frying pan was always at just the right temperature. The proportion of things was always bang on. Nothing was ever burnt or undercooked, nothing too hot or too cold. Every meal was simply perfect, only just beyond the reach of my hands. By degrees, the range of my appetite increased. Whereas at first I gutted fish and peeled their skin fastidiously, soon I no more than rinsed off their slimy slipperiness before biting into them, delighted to have such a treat between my teeth. I recall flying fish as being quite tasty, their flesh rosy white and tender. Dorado had a firmer texture and a stronger taste. I began to pick at fish heads rather than toss them to Richard Parker or use them as bait. It was a great discovery when I found that a fresh-tasting fluid could be sucked out not only from the eyes of larger fish, but also from their vertebrae. Turtles, which previously I had roughly opened up with the knife and tossed onto the floor of the boat for Richard Parker like a bowl of hot soup, became my favorite dish. It seems impossible to imagine that there was a time when I looked upon a live sea turtle as a 10-course meal of great delicacy, a blessed respite from fish. Yet so it was. In the veins of turtles coursed a sweet lassi that had to be drunk as soon as it spurted from their necks, because it coagulated in less than a minute. The best porials and kutas in the land could not rival turtle flesh, either cured brown or fresh deep red. No cardamom paisam I ever tasted was as sweet or as rich as creamy turtle eggs or cured turtle fat. A chopped-up mixture of heart, lungs, liver, flesh, and cleaned-out intestines sprinkled with fish parts, the whole soaked in a yolk and serum gravy, made an unsurpassable finger-licking thali. By the end of my journey, I was eating everything a turtle had to offer. In the algae that covered the shells of some hawksbills, I sometimes found small crabs and barnacles. Whatever I found in a turtle's stomach became my turn to eat. I whiled away many a pleasant hour gnawing at a flipper joint or splitting open bones and licking out their marrow. And my fingers were forever picking away at bits of dry fat and dry flesh that clung to the inner sides of shells, rummaging for food in the automatic way of monkeys. Turtle shells were very handy. I couldn't have done without them. They served not only as shields, but as cutting boards for fish and as bowls for mixing food. And when the elements had destroyed the blankets beyond repair, I used the shells to protect myself from the sun by propping them against each other and lying beneath them. It was frightening, the extent to which a full belly made for a good mood. The one would follow the other measure for measure. So much food and water, so much good mood. It was such a terribly fickle existence. I was at the mercy of turtle meat for smiles. By the time the last of the biscuits had disappeared, anything was good to eat, no matter the taste. I could put anything in my mouth, chew it and swallow it, delicious, foul or plain, so long as it wasn't salty. My body developed a revulsion for salt that I still experience to this day. I tried once to eat Richard Barker's feces. It happened early on, when my system hadn't learned yet to live with hunger and my imagination was still wildly searching for solutions. I had delivered fresh solar still water to his bucket not long before. After draining it in one go, he had disappeared below the tarpaulin, and I had returned to attending to some small matter in the locker. As I always did in those early days, I glanced below the tarpaulin every so often to make sure he wasn't up to something. Well, this one time, lo, he was. He was crouched, his back was rounded, and his rear legs were spread. His tail was raised, pushing up against the tarpaulin. The position was telltale. Right away I had food in mind, not animal hygiene. I decided there was little danger. He was turned the other way, and his head was out of sight. If I respected his peace and quiet, he might not even notice me. I grabbed a bailing cup and stretched my arm forward. My cup arrived in the nick of time. At the second it was in position at the base of his tail, Richard Barker's anus distended, and out of it, like a bubblegum balloon, came a black sphere of excrement. It fell into my cup with a clink, and no doubt I will be considered to have abandoned the last vestiges of humanness by those who do not understand the degree of my suffering when I say that it sounded to my ears like the music of a 5-rupee coin dropped into a beggar's cup. A smile cracked my lips and made them bleed. I felt deep gratitude towards Richard Barker. I pulled back the cup. I took the third in my fingers. It was very warm, but the smell was not strong. In size, it was like a big ball of gulab jamun, but with none of the softness. In fact, it was as hard as a rock. Load a musket with it and you could have shot a rhino. I returned the ball to the cup and added a little water. I covered it and set it aside. My mouth watered as I waited. When I couldn't stand the wait any longer, I popped the ball into my mouth. I couldn't eat it. The taste was acrid, but it wasn't that. It was rather my mouth's conclusion, immediate and obvious. There's nothing to be had here. It was truly waste matter with no nutrients in it. I spat it out and was bitter at the loss of precious water. I took the gaff and went about collecting the rest of Richard Barker's feces. They went straight to the fish. After just a few weeks, my body began to deteriorate. My feet and ankles started to swell, and I was finding it very tiring to stand. Chapter 78. There were many skies. The sky was invaded by great white clouds, flat on the bottom, but round and billowy on top. The sky was completely cloudless, of a blue quite shattering to the senses. The sky was a heavy, suffocating blanket of grey cloud, but without promise of rain. The sky was thinly overcast. The sky was dappled with small, white, fleecy clouds. The sky was streaked with high, thin clouds that looked like a cotton ball stretched apart. The sky was a featureless, milky haze. The sky was a density of dark and blustery rain clouds that passed by without delivering rain. The sky was painted with a small number of flat clouds that looked like sandbars. The sky was a mere block to allow a visual effect on the horizon. Sunlight flooding the ocean, the vertical edges between light and shadow perfectly distinct. The sky was a distant black curtain of falling rain. The sky was many clouds at many levels, some thick and opaque, others looking like smoke. The sky was black and spitting rain on my smiling face. The sky was nothing but falling water, a ceaseless deluge that wrinkled and bloated my skin and froze me stiff. There were many seas. The sea roared like a tiger. The sea whispered in your ear like a friend telling you secrets. The sea clinked like small change in a pocket. The sea thundered like avalanches. The sea hissed like sandpaper working on wood. The sea sounded like someone vomiting. The sea was dead silent. And in between the two, in between the sky and the sea, were all the winds. And there were all the nights and all the moons. To be a castaway is to be a point perpetually at the center of a circle. However much things may appear to change, the sea may shift from whisper to rage, the sky might go from fresh blue to blinding white to darkest black, the geometry never changes. Your gaze is always a radius. The circumference is ever great. In fact, the circles multiply. To be a castaway is to be caught in a harrowing ballet of circles. You are at the center of one circle, while above you two opposing circles spin about. The sun distresses you like a crowd, a noisy, invasive crowd that makes you cup your ears, that makes you close your eyes, that makes you want to hide. The moon distresses you by silently reminding you of your solitude. You open your eyes wide to escape your loneliness. When you look up, you sometimes wonder if at the center of a solar storm, if in the middle of the sea of tranquility, there isn't another one like you also looking up, also trapped by geometry, also struggling with fear, rage, madness, hopelessness, apathy. Otherwise, to be a castaway is to be caught up in grim and exhausting opposites. When it is light, the openness of the sea is blinding and frightening. When it is dark, the darkness is claustrophobic. When it is day, you are hot and wish to be cool and dream of ice cream and pour seawater on yourself. When it is night, you are cold and wish to be warm and dream of hot curries and wrap yourself in blankets. When it is hot, you are parched and wish to be wet. When it rains, you are nearly drowned and wish to be dry. When there is food, there is too much of it and you must feast. When there is none, there is truly none and you starve. When the sea is flat and motionless, you wish it would stir. When it rises up and the circle that imprisons you is broken by hills of water, you suffer that peculiarity of the high seas, suffocation in open spaces, and you wish the sea would be flat again. The opposites often take place at the same moment, so that when the sun is scorching you till you are stricken down, you are also aware that it is drying the strips of fish and meat that are hanging from your lines and that it is a blessing for your solar stills. Conversely, when a rain squall is replenishing your fresh water supplies, you also know that the humidity will affect your cured provisions and that some will probably go bad, turning pasty and green. When rough weather abates and it becomes clear that you have survived the sky's attack and the sea's treachery, your jubilation is tempered by the rage that so much fresh water should fall directly into the sea, and by the worry that it is the last rain you will ever see, that you will die of thirst before the next drops fall. The worst pair of opposites is boredom and terror. Sometimes your life is a pendulum swing from one to the other. The sea is without a wrinkle. There is not a whisper of wind. The hours last forever. You are so bored, you sink into a state of apathy close to a coma. Then the sea becomes rough, and your emotions are whipped into a frenzy. Yet even these two opposites do not remain distinct. In your boredom, there are elements of terror. You break down into tears. You are filled with dread. You scream. You deliberately hurt yourself. And in the grip of terror, the worst storm, you yet feel boredom. A deep weariness with it all. Only death consistently excites your emotions, whether contemplating it when life is safe and stale, or fleeing it when life is threatened and precious. Life on a lifeboat isn't much of a life. It is like an end game in chess, a game with few pieces. The elements couldn't be more simple, nor the stakes higher. Physically, it is extraordinarily arduous, and morally, it is killing. You must make adjustments if you want to survive. Much becomes expendable. You get your happiness where you can. You reach a point where you're at the bottom of hell, yet you have your arms crossed and a smile on your face, and you feel you're the luckiest person on earth. Why? Because at your feet, you have a tiny dead fish. Chapter 79. There were sharks every day, mainly makos and blue sharks, but also oceanic white tips. And once a tiger shark strayed from the blackest of nightmares. Dawn and dusk were their favorite times. They never seriously troubled us. On occasion, one knocked the hull of the lifeboat with its tail. I don't think it was accidental. Other marine life did it too, turtles and even dorados. I believe it was part of a shark's way of determining the nature of the lifeboat. A good whack on the offender's nose with a hatchet-scented vanishing post-haste into the deep. The main nuisance of sharks was that they made being in the water risky, like trespassing on a property where there's a sign saying, "Beware of dog." Otherwise, I grew quite fond of sharks. They were like curmudgeonly old friends who would never admit that they liked me, yet came around to see me all the time. The blue sharks were smaller, usually no more than 4 or 5 feet long, and the most attractive, sleek and slender with small mouths and discreet gill slits. Their backs were a rich ultramarine, and their stomachs snow-white, colors that vanished to gray or black when they were at any depth, but which close to the surface sparkled with surprising brilliance. The makos were larger and had mouths bursting with frightening teeth, but they too were nicely colored, an indigo blue that shimmered beautifully in the sun. The oceanic white tips were often shorter than the makos, some of which stretched to 12 feet, but they were much stockier and had enormous dorsal fins that they sailed high above the surface of the water, like a war banner, a rapidly moving sight that was always nerve-wracking to behold. Besides, they were a dull color, a sort of grayish brown, and the mottled white tips of their fins held no special attraction. I caught a number of small sharks, blue sharks for the most part, but some makos too. Each time it was just after sunset, in the dying light of the day, and I caught them with my bare hands as they came close to the lifeboat. The first one was my largest, a mako over 4 feet long. It had come and gone near the bow several times,